Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and the total health environment. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, science, and policy, media critic, popular attitudes, and what goes on underneath the surface of what we believe and have come to hold true and act upon. Each week on Connect the Dots, I talk with different thought leaders, activists, filmmakers, poets, novelists, authors, scientists, about different facets of all of these different things and how they impact us and our well-being, the well-being of our communities, the well-being of our society, and the ecological stability of our habitat, this lovely planet. On today's show, I am delighted to bring somebody that I have been aware of and informed by for many, many years. He is J.P. Alcpigny, the Bioneers Conference Associate Producer, and in the past he actually was a director of the New York Open Center. He's had a lot to do with Bioneers, the wonderful annual environmental conference. He's a New York City-based consultant, conference producer, copy editor, and writer. You know, so the chances are, if you're aware of either the Open Center, Bioneers, or the environmental movement, JP has had, some influence on shaping that as an important part of our contemporary understanding, dialogue, and activism. He has also authored and edited several books, including Political Ecosystems, Delusions of Normality, love that title, Visionary Plant Consciousness, and most recently, Animal Encounters, what could be better than that? So on the show today, I got in touch with JP about appearing here on Connect the Dots because of two recent articles of his, which are quite brilliant, really get to the heart of what we are all struggling with right now. And you can also, we'll refer to them throughout the program, and you can also look those up. They're on Medium. The first is called The 21st Century's Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Four Deep Drivers of Destabilization. And the other is called The Barbarians Inside the Gates, Can the Center Hold? And we'll be talking about both articles on today's show. So welcome to Connect the Dots, JP. Thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thank you.
One of the things, I think we should begin with the four deep drivers of destabilization, but I just want to frame it so that, to let listeners know that, part of the issue in looking at these and kind of is that we need to have an understanding, we need to get our minds around these, we need to face up to them, at the same time without becoming, ready to give up and die, which is, sometimes I feel that way, quite honestly. I mean, it's like really hard to imagine given the frame of kind of regular normalcy that we regard ourselves as living in. And so we're going to be talking about that too as we progress through the show. But JP, would you please give our listeners, a kind of basic overview of the four deep drivers that we have to contend with in this time?
Right, and I don't mean that these are the only, forces that are threatening us, and also they're so closely interrelated that separating them, is sort of an intellectual, way to make a convenient point. But anyway, yes, to get to them. So my idea was to just back up a bit, and, we're so caught up in the politics of the moment, very understandably, that I just want to take a step back and try to have a hierarchy of threat, in the same way that we become obsessed with, terrorism. What are really the most dire challenges that we face as a species and that the biosphere faces? And so, in a nutshell, I think that one that's really underappreciated these days is the nuclear threat. And I think that the risk of some type of limited or larger nuclear conflagration are a lot greater now than they were during the sort of static period of the Cold War. And I think that the leading, force behind that, I think, in the long term is the China-U.S. rivalry, which I think could conceivably get a lot of countries surrounding China, such as Japan, Korea, you know, possibly in the long term Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, to all consider arming themselves if they feel that the U.S. nuclear umbrella and that U.S. power is waning and that that umbrella would no longer protect them, Australia even. So that's one, you know, area. And then, of course, you have the India-Pakistan situation and, you know, there are, and of course, the hot spots in the Middle East and so on, and Iran and, you know, Israel and so on. So that's something that I think, you know, we have to face, and it's something that was very present in people's minds in the 50s. I grew up in that generation where we had drills hiding under our desks and so on, and I don't want people to be terrified, but I think, you know, we definitely have to understand that that's a real threat. So related to that was the question of geopolitics, which I just touched on with the China-U.S. rivalry, and, you know, I think history, you know, has unkind lessons to offer in the sense that there's a what historians call Thucydides' trap, the fact that when there's a rising power and a declining one, even if it's still very powerful, very often war is a result, usually, in fact. It's the norm, not the exception. My own hope is that if there is a U.S.-China engagement, that it would be a limited one in the South China Sea and not involve nuclear weapons, but one never knows. These things can spiral out of control, as World War I sort of a classic example of that. So, you know,
I just want to parenthetically state for a second,
yeah,
CP, that when you're talking about a declining power, despite the rhetoric of making America great again, you're talking about the United States as a declining power. Isn't that so?
Right. And by a declining power, let's be clear, I mean, we spend more money on defense than the next seven countries and, you know, 40% of the world's expenditures on defense. And we're by far the most gigantic military power and still a dominant economic power. So I'm not getting into this, oh, you know, America's on the decline. I'm just saying China is, you know, has increased its you know, its power enormously by leaps and bounds. And I don't think, you know, Chinese history, I don't think the Chinese yearn to be the dominant power on Earth. I don't think that's part of their historical pattern. But I do think they want to be the dominant power in Asia, in their part of Asia. And the U.S. policy has sort of been since Admiral Perry forced the Japanese to open their, you know, their island to commerce and colonialism, that the U.S. doesn't tolerate the idea of another dominant power in Asia. So that's where the, you know, the conflict could, you know, I don't claim to predict the future. I'm just saying these are real, you know, real things we have to look at. And it's a big geopolitical game. You know, what will Russia's role be? Russia and China historically have a very mutually suspicious relationship. They have fought armed battles, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, I believe. And, you know, it wasn't widely publicized at the time, but, you know, they're good friends at the moment. But historically, the Russians are sort of terrified that the Chinese will eye Siberia with its vast open spaces and forests and minerals and oil and gas and their burgeoning population. So, you know, it's a complex world. It's a very, very complex world, and it's going to be increasingly a multipolar world. You know, very reminiscent of Orwell's, you know, East Asia, Eurasia, you know, Oceania type of division of into power blocks and so on. So the geopolitical situation is more unstable, is my basic point. And then, of course, the other two drivers, besides, you know, the threat of nuclear, you know, war and geopolitics, are of course the environmental crisis, which is the other giant elephant in the room. And you know, and I think that we focus a lot on climate change, as we should, because it's a definitely, you know, definitely an existential crisis. But I think there are other things we, you know, that other people outside the environmental movement don't focus enough on. You know, the toxification of the environment, the amount of plastics in the ocean, the fact that a lot of ecosystems are becoming less and less resilient as we, you know, really alter the landscape in a massive way. And I think the most scary of all, you know, is the fact that the rising acidity of the oceans could one day really alter the equation of marine life, so that, you know, I mean, 50 to 80% of the oxygen that's generated by plant life comes from plankton in the oceans. So if one day we disrupt that chain, I mean, that really is an existential crisis in terms of actual survival of many species, including us, on the planet. So the environmental crisis, you know, I think is the, in my view, it's absurd to even consider it an issue because, you know, if you're a fetus in your mother's womb is not an issue. It's where you live. It's everything. And, you know, that's our relationship to the matrix of life, which is Earth. So I think somehow the environmental movement has failed to convey the fact that, you know, the eco issues are not issues. They're where we live. They're us. They're our bodies. They're, you know, I'm sure you've been over this many times with your audience, so I don't need to hammer this point home with your particular audience. But it's shocking to me how, you know, in our political process, the environment comes up so infrequently. It's almost, you know, incomprehensible. Anyway, I don't want to get on a high horse about that.
Well, we're going to open up that part of the conversation a little more after we've heard about, because, yeah, I want to talk with you more about that, because I know it's something you've thought about a great deal. So have I, so have my listeners. So we'll talk a little bit about what that disconnect is about. But, let's hear about the fourth driver,
last one,
and then we'll go from there.
Right. So the last one is basically technological change, and especially, and so I would call it, you know, sociocultural and change as affected by technological change. So what I mean by that is that roboticization and AI, the developments in AI, I mean, I think in the long term, genetic technologies might have the biggest impact on the species as we know it, but I don't think that's going to be the main driver in the next, you know, 30 years or so. I think it might be an enormous factor, and I think we're going to have to really work to prevent a rise of a new eugenics, and so that's a deep issue. But in the next few decades, I think a bigger factor is going to be the fact that many, many working class and middle class jobs are going to be eliminated by roboticization and by AI. And I don't think anyone has figured out, you know, the solution to that. The idea that somehow miraculously more jobs will be created in some new as yet unknown professions, I don't buy it, you know. And I think that one of the real deep reasons for the political instability we've been seeing in the Western world and beyond, of course, each country is different and has its own set of dynamics, but I think that the fact that many of the working class and middle class people, you know, who are, especially ones who are more rural or suburban or ex-urban and who are more attached to their traditions, they feel that they're losing ground. And, you know, they're not suffering the way people in third world countries are suffering, but it's when people begin to lose ground or feel that they're not gaining ground and that they're, you know, becoming disenfranchised and that they're prone to xenophobic reactions and to being manipulated, you know, as we see by you know, populist right-wing politicians. So I think that those, you know, and I think we're going to have to really, you know, ideally we're going to have to really rethink our economic ideas. This was discussed very widely in the 50s when many, many thinkers predicted that automation would eliminate the need for many jobs and people were talking about post-scarcity. This was a big conversation in the 50s and 40s, 50s and 60s that in early 60s that kind of disappeared today because people said, oh, those people were completely wrong. We have, you know, we need a lot of workers, blah, blah, blah. But often people are right, they're just their time frame is wrong. You know, like Club of Rome predicted we'd run out of many minerals, but they were completely wrong in their time frame. And Malthus was wrong about population by several hundred years. But it doesn't mean that the deep idea of limits and scarcity aren't real. You know, it's just predicting about time frames is a fool's errand. But anyway, so those were the four things I had identified, you know, the nuclear threat, geopolitical threats, the social disruption created by these technologies, and of course the environmental crisis. So those were the four, and they're related,
you know,
of course.
Yeah, they're obviously very interrelated. I mean, on the whole thing of robotics, I've had Robert McChesney on the show, and he did a whole book about, you know, what that's going to look like. There have been calls on the left to create, you know, a universal baseline income, you know, to sort of sustain people. And Sarah Leonard from The Nation has been on the show talking about that, for example. yet, given our current climate and where we are, you know, with, you know, willingness willingness to cut funding from Wheels on Meals on Wheels, you know, really, you know, attacking those who are infirm or in need in any way. The notion, you know, the sort of progressive notion, or the, you know, the compassionate notion of, you know, the people come first and we should provide this in the current economic framework, seems like an, you know, kind of absurd fantasy, barring some sudden, you know, miraculous Anantio drama or change, you know, where it goes as far. Anantio drama is a term that I guess I first encountered, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, used by Jung, where, you know, something goes so far down a certain pathway that it kind of boomerangs back in the opposite direction.
Yeah. The problem with those things is they're unpredictable. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the mechanics of that happening, you know, are, it's like, you know, it's akin to a miracle, you know, hoping for something like that.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I think that, unfortunately, I mean, a lot of people on the left, I think, get you know, and I'm critiquing people on the left because I'm part of it, and so it's, you know, it's in the family, right? You know, we tend to look for these miraculous things because we get so disheartened by the cold-heartedness of what we, you know, often that we encounter in opposing forces, that, you know, so certain ideas get really popular, like tipping point. Yeah, it's, we're going to reach a tipping point. And then, but we tend to have these fantasies that everything is going to coalesce the way we want it. You know, we'll have a green, feminist, you know, egalitarian society. It'll all kick into place. But that's not the way things work. It's like microbes, you know, and bacteria. They exchange DNA, and you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you could wind up with a feminist, fascist eco-state. I mean, who knows? I'm just saying, you know, cultural memes and ideas, it's very hard to predict. You know, it doesn't mean one shouldn't do one best to advocate and to work for those values one holds dear, but it's also important to be realistic and grounded in the actual alignment of social forces, the actual alignment of ideas as they are, and to work. You know, I think people on the left should do better to read, you know, Sun Tzu's Art of War and, you know, some texts that are more read by the right, or Hobbes or Machiavelli. You know, these people, there's a reason that those texts have lasted a very long time. You know, I'm not saying one should become cynical or Machiavellian, literally, but there are, you know, one has to learn how to be realistic about power and you know, calculating, not in a nasty way, but about how to achieve one's goals, given the actual terrain. You know, Sun Tzu talks of, or, well, Sun Tzu, there wasn't really a Sun Tzu, but whoever that, you know, work is attributed to, talk about understanding yourself, understanding the opponent, and understanding the terrain. If you don't understand those things really deeply, your chances of success are very limited, you know, so...
What
anyway.
Is it among those three, I like that line of thought, what is there among those three that we're not understanding very well? One thing that I would nominate, you know, raising hands, we can begin with that and move on to the others, but is I don't think we understand ourselves very well. You know, we have a very idealistic vision of our, and this is coming out of the, you know, kind of movement for enlightenment and wisdom and growth and self-understanding, you know, that both you and I in different degrees come out of, and I see it everywhere. You know, are we able to really look at our own buy-in and participation, or do we always kind of put the white hat on ourselves because we're not as bad as the other guy? So the whole thing of somebody is worse, well, somebody is worse in this situation, obviously.
No doubt. Yeah.
But, you know, where are we? Is it a failure to understand the adverse forces, a misunderstanding of the terrain, a lack of civic know-how? Is it a, you know, a failure to face one's own shadow side? You know, where, or all of the above, where would you locate it?
Well, I'd locate it in all of them because, you know, by understanding ourselves, okay, so we can talk individually. Of course, we all have blind spots, right? So, you know, I mean, a good therapist can't just put a mirror in front of you psychologically or you'll die. They have to show you a tiny little bit of yourself slowly but surely. so that gradually you'll come to see more of yourself. But it's a bit like, you know, mystics talk about seeing God, and you, if you're not ready, you'll just keel over and die. So, you know, self-knowledge is difficult. But in terms of a movement, I think knowing oneself means knowing your strengths and weaknesses, knowing how much support you actually have. So to give an example, the environmental movement, we tend to overstate in a lot of our, you know, rhetoric, oh, you know, 80% of people support clean air, clean water. Yeah, that might be true, but it's soft support. They don't support it enough to vote, to put that at the top of their, you know, factors for voting. So we overstate how much support we have because, you know, of course, one needs PR. But if you start believing your own PR, you're in trouble. So in terms of a movement, that's just one example that we overestimate our own strengths. And a lot of that, as you say, comes from, you know, the Enlightenment and I think from Rousseau, this idea that people are fundamentally good and it's social forces that you know, divert them from their goodness. You know, and we tend to, on the left, assume that if a rational argument will convince people. But as we've discovered, and more thinkers, you know, economists and so on, are realizing that the idea of the rational actor in economics is a fiction. People have a lot of irrational, you know, a lot of behavior comes from irrational or, you know, unconscious factors. So that's one domain, and that's complicated. There's a lot of different ways to unpack that. Understanding the terrain means you have to look at the country that you're in or the world that you're in, and let's take the United States. You know, there are very, very deep pockets of deeply religious, traditional, regions of the country and groups of people, and they've been there a long, long time. You know, there's a deep, deep sort of Calvinist Puritan thread that makes a lot of people feel that if you're poor, this is unconscious largely, but I think of what you were a lot talking about of the hard-heartedness on the right, a lot of these people never accepted the New Deal. I think someone like Paul Ryan comes out of this kind of wing of the conservative movement that really feels that basically if you're poor, something is spiritually wrong with you, that sort of Calvinist view.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying the whole right is like that. There are conservatives who are quite compassionate who just feel that government intervention doesn't work. I mean, there are people you can have actual discourse with on the right, but not the ones who are in the most dominant positions at the moment, obviously. So that's the terrain, I think, you know, and then understanding the opponent means really having an understanding of, okay, so here's the landscape of the right. What's in that landscape? Who could we talk to that we could agree with on certain things? You know, for instance, now you're seeing with internet privacy, alliances of the libertarian right with people all over the left. You know, the only way to succeed when you're not dominant or strong, as the left isn't, is to figure out wise tactical alliances for goals that you want to achieve and seeing where on the political landscape you can draw support for those particular aims. So it's understanding the landscape, as I call it. My book, Political Ecosystems, deals with that a lot. And I think that we just wind up just thinking if we have rational argumentation, we're so obviously right about so many things, and I tend to think we are for the most part because I come out of the left. But, you know, rational argumentation will not work. The same, you know, even, you know, if you're in a couple, the same words and the same actions that for you might be soothing might not be soothing to your partner. You might bring home some yellow flowers, but that the person you're living with, you don't know this, hates yellow and can't stand the smell of that particular flower. You know, you have to know who you're dealing with, you know what I mean? I could go on, but those are the knowing yourself, knowing the opponent, knowing the terrain, yeah.
Let me just throw, you know, this one out, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the environmental disconnect. I recently had on the show Daniel Pinchbeck, whose recent book is called How Soon Is Now, and he goes over some of the issues that you've discussed in this article, and probably all of them, actually, in various degrees of depth. One of the things that was quite kind of astounding to me about his book is the fact that he is fundamentally optimistic about how radical change could happen very rapidly and instantaneously. Part of his confidence about that. And the reason I'm asking you this question is he bases it on his own experiences of being in settings where plant medicine is used in ritual ways and people have consciousness-altering experiences. And, you know, people of all kinds of backgrounds perceiving, you know, kind of a bigger frame or an expansion of consciousness, he believes, based on his experiences in that realm, could very rapidly change, come up with new inventions and new strategies and alter the political landscape that we are dealing with, you know, quite rapidly and radically with, you know, a lot of people having a sign on. And the reason that I ask you that question is that you've written a book about, you know, plant consciousness. It's something that you've spoken about and all of that. And you know, he integrates that into this in a particular way. So I was curious, you know, how you would see that.
Yeah. Well, the book I didn't actually write. I edited a collection, and that actually includes a talk. It was a collection of talks given at the Bioneers Conference over a 15-year period on the topic of psychoactive plant, sacred plant use, and psychedelics in general, and their role and their social and role in the environmental movement and so on. Look, I think these are incredibly powerful substances. A lot of, you know, the ayahuasca underground is really big and thriving at the moment and in all kinds of interesting and some silly and some fascinating ways. And, you know, a lot of people find, you know, personal healing sometimes, you know, not invariably. But I'd say a few things. I have a deep experience with this. I come out of the, you know, 60s generation and, you know, I don't want to incriminate myself, but let's just say I am no stranger to these things. And I think that there's a tendency, I mean, psychedelics are amazing tools, but all tools that are powerful can be dangerous as well, right? They can be dangerous on the personal level for people who have, you know, schizophrenia or whatever in their families. So certain people have to be careful. By and large, I think they can be very positive, used intelligently, but they also tend to inflate utopianism. They can be great boosters of, you know, they can be great at spiritual inflation. Because people can take a psychedelic and see God or think they've started a new religion, especially when they're young and inexperienced, you know. And I think there's an enormous amount of naivete. And Daniel was touting all this 2012 blah, blah, blah nonsense, you know, back in the day. Look, I know Daniel and he's a sweet guy. But so I think there's, you know, and that idea is an idea that someone I knew quite well back in the day, Terence McKenna, spoke about. In fact, he has a talk in the book that I edited about this, that he feels that the ecological emergency is so pressing that we don't have time, and the only way is to radically get a lot of people to take massive doses of mushrooms so they'll see the light and understand our connection to the earth. I just don't buy that scenario, because I've seen enough. I mean, when I was first, saw the LSD culture back in the 60s when I was quite young, some of the first people I saw taking it were like right-wing military types who were taking acid and watching the news and go, bomb Hanoi, you know. So you can take psychedelics and it can inflate what's already there, right? If you're a Christian, you might see Jesus. If you're a Buddhist, you might see Buddha. I mean, I'm not saying they're fascinating tools, and I cannot have imagined having lived without having partaken of these things, and I think they're very important. But I think one can get carried away with a kind of utopian zeal, and it's this idea that there's a shortcut, that we can radically boost people's consciousness, in a way that will change things. I just think it's naive. I wish it were true. My God, I wish there were a magic potion that we could sprinkle the fairy dust and everyone would see the light and love the earth. Sadly, I do not buy into that scenario.
Well, you know, that goes back to the very core thing about, you know, the 100th monkey. If more of us work on ourselves personally, which is always a good project if you have the, the privilege, the time, and the economic situation to do it. I don't want to denigrate that project at all. But the notion that if enough of us could somehow do it without kind of the frame of reference of how many really have the full time to devote to, you know, to that effort, that all will change, and that therefore on the social action level, it's less of an important project, or the two projects are in fact equivalent. you know, the social action project and the inner action project or the inner transformation project, and even the sense that one can't participate in civic action if one still has personal issues of various kinds that will therefore taint one's social activism. I'd love to hear your commentary on that.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing, because when I was, you know, a young activist, I had one foot in both camps. I was kind of a hippie, you know, and I was also, you know, an SDS type back in the day, right? So, and that was a very uneasy, you know, place to have 2 feet in two very different kind of mindsets. I mean, a lot of people found themselves in that position where there was sort of a very stark division between the people who were advocating, you know, social change and marching in the streets and the war and so on. And for a while, everybody was kind of on the same boat, but then the divisions really set in, and you had, you know, in pop culture, you had the Beatles singing Revolution Number 9, basically, or the Who saying We Won't Be Fooled Again, and then the Rolling Stones had Street Fighting Man. So you could pick, you know, which one group of rock bands was advocating, no, you just have to work on yourself spiritually and the world will change, and the other ones were advocating getting down the street. Of course, they were all, you know,
commercial.
Those the people themselves. Well, they were all interesting people, but there was this division between the people who said no, you have to work on yourself, because if you participate in social revolutionary movements and you haven't changed yourself in a deep way or looked at yourself, you're just going to bring the same old problems. And it's true that if we look at political revolutions in history, especially the French and Russian revolutions, one could really argue that was the bloodshed worth it? You know, was the terror in France and Stalin? You know, these are deep questions. So the people on the spiritual side have some good points to make. But it's also naive to think that if a few Westerners just, you know, chant their mantra and meditate. The most absurd sort of the epitome of this was the harmonic convergence. I don't know how old you are, but this
that.
Is something. Yeah, and so this idea that Jose Arguelles, who was an interesting character, I think he died a couple years ago, but he was talking about how we have to all, I have got this revelation that if 144,000 of us gather at all these sacred spots on Earth, which are like the acupuncture nodes of the planet, and we all meditate at the same time, we will change history and the Mayan calendar won't have to result in destruction 25 years later. And everyone I knew was rushing, where are you going on the harmonic convergence? And I said, excuse me, have you read Arguelles' book? None of them had even heard of Jose Arguelles. Hardly any of them had read his work, and somehow they, and so certainly none of them critically, and they were racing to, as though this would change world history, and the arrogance of that, as though, you know, Tibetan monks who had been meditating for generations in caves ferociously, and, you know, and people all over the world who, you know, Sufi mystics who'd been praying and meditating, somehow 144,000 yuppie types, you know, dancing around for one day in these so-called sacred sites that Jose Arguelles had identified, just the absurdity of it. The problem is that I think part of it, there's a pathos to it, that all of us are so desperate for these magical solutions because the problems that we face are so, you know, look, human history has been a pretty ugly affair, so problems were always steep. If you were around during the Black Plague or when Genghis Khan was passing through town, you know, let's not sugarcoat the human past or working in coal mines in Britain during the Industrial Revolution when you were 10 years old. But the problems now do seem of a different nature because they're global. You know, the global environmental crisis and the global nuclear threats, even when the Roman Empire collapsed, it was still regional. You know, it was big. But you know, I understand. You can't look around at the world and not be brokenhearted. But you also have to love life and lead a fulfilled life to the extent you can. Sort of that's the prime directive, right? My thanks to Star Trek. So, you know, it's tough. I had a friend said you have to have an open, broken heart. That's sort of the only way. And that's tough. It's very tough to live that way. But I don't think there's an easy solution. There's not a magic bullet. There's only generations of work and doing your best, but trying not to be depressed along the way and try to love life and you make sure you save as much room to enjoy it as possible as long as you're not harming others. And, you know, so it's tough. But I don't – these magic solutions, I wish they were – you know, I wish they worked, but I don't believe in them, you know.
One of the things that you talk about in the article is there are different levels. And so, you know, it's kind of like we are, you know, we're living within a human embodiment, within a, you know, within our personal consciousness, with our own unconscious patterns, but we're also in a place, in a neighborhood, in a community. We're in a society or a state, you know, or a city that has different issues going on. I mean, I devoted a number of years of my life to fighting, protecting the water of New York State, just as, you know, from fracking, just as is happening now where people of the, you know, Northwest region and the indigenous people are protecting their water, land, food, et cetera, from, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline. So, you know, all of that exists in us simultaneously. And, you know, what you're describing is our, you know, the difficulty in having a framework that encompasses the different levels, you know, of our own being and participation in a way where we are addressing and using, you know, using the right tools for the right level at any given time, you know, where we have a framework for having that sort of conversation. Now, I'm sure this must be something that you have pondered long and hard and pioneers, you know, which is a pioneering conference in looking at all of that. You know, what do you see as the framework that people can understand and adopt so that we don't constantly persist in recreating this kind of level confusion?
Well, look, I think part of the confusion is just being alive. We don't even understand consciousness, really, right? I mean, there's these tremendous mysteries. And so there's an enormous mystery to life, which is great, I think, you know, and exploring that, you never resolve it, but exploring that is great, great fun for those of us who like to do that. But I think that one way that might be helpful to think of this is if one thinks of you know, sort of the political and the social landscape as an ecosystem, right? So in an ecosystem, there are different species, you know, so you might go out to Yellowstone and there are bears and there are elk and there are wolves and, you know, those are the top predators and you've got, you know, foxes and, you know, voles and, you know, all kinds of, you know, animals and not to mention the insects and the ants and the trees. And so a lot of these are sort of, you know, enemies in a sense. You've got the bears and hunting the elk and the wolves and so on. And, well, the bears are, you know, the wolves hunt the elk more. But so if we think of it in the same way, we have to understand that our community, our country, the world, there are opposing factors and opponents, but how do you live with them? If there's a keystone species, you know, if you're an elk, you're not going to get rid of wolves. They're there. So how do you adjust? How do you adapt? How do you, if elks could think that way, how will the elk community do well despite the existence of wolves? So we have to think a bit in the same way. Well, there's going to be a right wing. It's not going to disappear. It's been here for hundreds of years in different ways. You know, what does that mean? How do we weaken it when we can, work with parts of it when we can, strengthen our own, you know, part of the ecosystem. And then another way that's very helpful, I find, is thinking of oneself. Where do I fit in? What are my natural affinities, my natural talents? You know, maybe someone in the movement is really, you know, has a lot of sort of physical courage. They're young. They're good for going out and getting arrested at nonviolent demonstrations. Someone else is kind of much more straight and has gone to law school. But you'll be really glad when you're that tree sitter who got arrested that someone went to law school who's willing to defend you for free. So instead of saying, oh, you're just a straight jerk and you should take some ayahuasca in my teepee, or the other person saying, oh, you're just a filthy hippie taking drugs, you say, you know, we all need each other. We're all part of this larger ecosystem. We don't all agree with each other all the time in many ways, but we're part of an ecosystem. So that's a different way of thinking. Instead of I'm right in my camp, you're wrong in your camp. Yes, there are things that are wrong, and there are enemies. It's a question of power. We can't all just, you know, I want to love everybody. That isn't, you know, on a deep level maybe, you know, when you're in deep meditation state and you have this sort of feeling of we're all connected. That's, you know, that's completely viable. I mean, it's completely real in one way. Ram Dass had a funny thing he said about that. He said, you know, there's a question of appropriate spiritual ideas and when they're inopportune or inappropriate. So an example is you live in a household and it's Monday is your turn to do the dishes. Everybody's Tuesday is someone else and Wednesday is someone else. And then, you know, and you're all, you know, committed to a spiritual lifestyle and you all meditate together and all this. And you know, you believe that deep down we're all one and so on. And then so Monday rolls around, your turn to do dishes, and you turn to the other person and say, you know what, we're all one, it doesn't matter. Why don't you just do the dishes again? Since we're all one, it doesn't matter. See, that's an inappropriate use of a spiritual meme. So it's a question of honoring the different levels. Each one has to be honored, the physical level, the spiritual level, the sociopolitical level. And also to view them as living systems, as dynamic living systems. So often people on the left talk about being more holistic and so on, but when it comes to their political ideas, they're just painfully literal and linear. So I think that if we try to look at what would a more holistic, fluid way of looking at sociopolitical landscapes and at our own psychology and how we fit in. So that, you know, it's not easy to do, and it's not, you don't arrive at a definitive answer or solution. And sometimes you have to have hard positions on issues. I'm not denying that at all. But a more, you know, a more realistic but fluid way of looking at the sociopolitical landscape, I think, would be helpful.
That really makes a lot of sense. That's very, very interesting. Could you give an example of, you know, where you see like a you know, a righteous but misplaced hard line, just so we kind of have that example? I mean, what would be a good example of that?
Well, I mean, right now, at the so, I mean, this is going to be rile up a lot of, you know, opposition. People will be angry at me for saying this. But I think, for example, in the last election, you know, being right and being helpful are not always the same thing. I mean, anyone knows from real life that if you tell the absolute truth to everyone you're in a relationship with or your family, you're going to be crucified. You know, and there are comedies about this. And you, so one doesn't going around, because the truth can be, you know, a weapon rather than helpful at times. So let's say Jill Stein, right? So I might agree with most of the tenets of, you know, her platform more than I would with Hillary's. But in that political context, with the risk of what we're seeing now, I think it was absurd for people to vote for the Green Party. You know, and I used to be a registered Green, but I'm just saying, this is my personal political take. But I think that's a failure to understand the moment. And, you know, I'm not saying this is a similar situation because we're not in an armed conflict, but during the World War II in the French Resistance, you had royalists, you had communists working side by side because they knew they had a bigger goal, which was to end the Nazi occupation of their country. Now, I think at the moment, I mean, I'm not saying we're in an analogous situation, but I personally believe that derailing the Trump agenda, that this really is something beyond the pale. It's not just traditional conservative republicanism. It's something far more dangerous. And there are quite a few people on the right, even in the CIA, even people who have historically been our enemies and opponents, who also really see that danger. And I think right now that the historical moment is demanding of us that we build as broad-based coalitions as possible across the political spectrum to derail this particular threat. You know, when the zombies are running down the street, you don't worry about whether the person next to you agrees with you about everything, right? So, that's my own feeling. Now, I want to get into a little bit of a deeper issue with this, which is that about finding one's niche. I think there are people who are drawn to purity in a political sense. So they're really focused on what an ideal society in their own, you know, what to them is an ideal society. And I think all politics are at their core informed by a utopian vision of what a perfect society would be. But let's say that you really feel tainted working in the political system and the compromises and, you know, which is pretty hideous. It's a pretty hideous process. So I think that's well and good, but then go and create, you know, a food co-op or a publishing firm, whatever it is, you know, a daycare center that really lives up to your highest ideals of what you would like a society to look like. I think that's perfectly valid, or set up a political party that has those ideals. But where it breaks down is when you only think that anyone who subscribes to that is right and everyone else is wrong. I think you have to wear two hats. The modern world demands of us the ability to put on different lenses. You know, the sort of post-postmodern condition requires of us that we be able to put on different hats and different lenses. You know, when I'm doing my taxes, I put on my rational, you know, calculating lens. When I'm taking ayahuasca in the woods, I put on my mystical, you know, nature-loving lens. You know, we have to, and the question is putting on the appropriate hat at the appropriate moment. So when an election rolls around that could really threaten deeply civil liberties and ravage the environment, you know, it's better to vote for the, you know, whoever will help you muddle through, even if it's someone you don't like or disagree with. You know, I say it would have been better to vote for a potted plant or, you know, a poodle than what we have, right? So, you know, so I just think sometimes you have to put your utopianism to one side and put on your realpolitik glasses on the other and understand that we're never going to have a perfect world. And it's fully valid to have a utopian ideal of what you'd like the ideal society to be and to work in your own way towards that. But that's the work of generations and generations. In the meanwhile, we have to live in the real world. And I think a lot of people who are sort of left revolutionaries think anything that isn't the revolution is a sellout. Anything that's not intensifying the contradictions to show how the evils of capitalism is a sellout. And that's fine if you're really in a revolutionary moment. But if you're not, and we're definitely not, and we haven't been in this country probably ever, right? So then you're just deluding yourself. And then sometimes you can do more harm than good.
Well, it's interesting. I actually belong to a food co-op in Brooklyn, and
right.
You know, and yeah, and actually, there's a lot of politics. I, you know, have a particular service position that, you know, is somewhat senior, and there's plenty of politics there, and there's a lot of work to be done there in terms of, you know, making the policies more humane and looking at how.
And the worst battles are often in the family. You know, I mean, when I was in the left, I mean, the battles between the weathermen and progressive labor and between, you know, so, you know, what's your position on ambidextrous Palestinian biodynamic? You know, I mean, it just gets into, you know, yeah, we have a lot of different positions on different things, and that's all well and good, but you have to, in critical moments, put them aside. And, yeah, look, I mean, there are a lot of very neurotic people on the left and in spiritual movements and people looking, I mean, you know, this is a deeper issue, but we all live with a very deep alienation, and a lot of us are wounded. Most of us are in some way neurotic and wounded in our culture, and that's a deeper question, I think, that about, you know, our species, we live for 99% of our evolutionary trajectory as small pack mammals, you know, small pack primates, and in small bands in our hunting-gathering phase. And we're only very recently living in larger agglomerations and groups of people where we don't know who people are in the street. And we live, a lot of us, in sort of social insects in these sort of stacked combs, you know. And, you know, and I think that that's very difficult because we haven't adjusted to that reality, and it's going so quickly where technological change and social change are so much more rapid than our capacity for moral evolution. And that's a very difficult adjustment to make, and that's why we're seeing so many problems. And I don't know what the solution is to that. I don't think there are ultimate solutions. We just have to work as best we can to understand the conditions we're in, try to be as compassionate as we can be, but also be realistic. And, you know, I think the toughest thing is that where does one draw the line? So we can disagree with each other about things and still work together, but sometimes someone crosses a line where we no longer feel that we can work with them. Because, and that's very tough because different people draw the line in different places. So those hardcore revolutionary types will draw the line much further to the left than I would. But there are times where, you know, you can't. So, for instance, if Donald Trump calls one of us up and says, listen, I think you have some good ideas, come to Trump Tower. If you do that because suddenly you think you're going to get a hearing and you might be able to get the ideas that you've had your whole life. You know, we saw that with Bobby Kennedy Jr., right, recently. But you risk just discrediting yourself for all time if you cross certain lines. So it's very tough because people put those lines in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an easy answer to that. I mean, there are corporations, or the Catholic Church, you know, the Catholic Church and the CIA and the American government has the Peace Corps, and then they have assassins. The Catholic Church had the Franciscans who love animals and the Dominicans who burned Albigensians at the stake. So often within the same giant organization, you could work with some people. There might be people who are really authentically green in some big corporations, while another branch of the corporation is overthrowing a government and pilfering the natural resources. So it's very tough because I think we just have to take a really, really hard look at the systems as they exist. You know, is it really worth going out and fighting Starbucks or Whole Foods? And yes, I'd rather see a world of mom-and-pop stores and cafes, but is that really productive in a world of Exxon and Monsanto to pick on those type of things? So it's very, look, I do not have any answers. All I'm selling is think hard and try to find a good niche and do the best you can. I know that's not a way to write a bestseller. You know, it's not easy. It's not thin thighs in 20 seconds or, whatever it is. But that's the best I can come up with.
Yeah, no, that's definitely, I think it's good advice in terms of where people put themselves on the spectrum. And also, I mean, just speaking for myself, one can have personal experiences that shift where you are. I've had invitations to, kind of target the Democratic Party, the neoliberals, in this current thing for their inability to kind of grasp things. For years, because I've covered both the TPP as well as the gas pipeline through Indian Point. We've been like hammering on Charles Schumer, the New York senator, who's a Wall Street guy, at the same time, and not regarding him, regarding him as a kind of corrupted sellout who won't really take substantive action. And yet, if he stood up against Gorsuch, I'm happy with him for today,
Right, right, and that's politics.
And,
that's politics.
So it's like,
Yeah, no, that's politics,
yeah.
And that's reality, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And also you have to pick, do we want to spend all our time tearing down people that we think are sellouts in some ways, but are vastly better than these other people who, really are a threat to the biosphere in a really, some people will say, well, if you vote for Democrats and Hillary Clinton, you would just get the same destruction of the biosphere, but more slowly. There's truth to that, but it creates more openings for change. You can at least get, I think there's a radical difference between Obama and, I do think, I don't want to get into specifics or politics, but I think people who think there's no difference are a little bit insane at the moment. And sometimes things are the best that you can do at the moment, and there's at least hope in one scenario, whereas in the other scenario, there's just devastation. So, I think these are really complicated issues, and I think it's issue by issue and staying open, and also being open to the fact that one might be wrong. I think a lot of people on the left have historically made terrible mistakes. A lot of the left stayed pro-Russian and pro-Stalin way longer than they should have in the 50s, in the 40s and 50s. And people like Sartre and who are really interesting people in other ways. But so one can make terrible historical mistakes at certain time by clinging to one's illusions. So, it's tough. If I had easy answers, I'd be, I don't know if I'd be rich and famous, but I wouldn't be as tortured as I am. But I accept being tortured. I think it's part of the human condition. So it's
Yeah. Well, it's a torturous thing to face what we're facing now, in terms of the tremendous risk to the environment. I mean, I recall you as being someone who was, kind of holding the flag for the environment relatively early on, back in the days when I was concentrating on personal health and exclusively, and what we each could do as individuals to sort of, optimize our own health without reference to what was going on that was feeding us, that was nourishing us, our connection to our habitat. There's so much disconnect there now. on the one hand, we have people, you know, trying to bring kids to the woods, for example. So the next generation,
yeah, yeah.
I have two of my nieces are doing farm education, you know, for elementary school kids. I mean, they're kind of seeding the next generation, and I'm super proud of them, obviously, and thrilled with what they're doing and with the fact that they have chosen to center their lives there, you know, and all of that. And at the same time, I kind of feel like, will we get there? Will there be, you know, a place for these next generations
that are
coming along?
I think a couple of things. Let's not lose hope, because
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of
mm-hmm.
movements, I mean, the food movement is an example of one where, and the alternative health movement, where we kind of won a lot of the battles, where the
mm-hmm.
medical establishment totally resisted all alternatives, and people voted with their wallets and their feet,
mm-hmm.
and they were forced to accept, you know, things like acupuncture and all kinds
mm-hmm.
of things. And I think the same is true with food. I mean, my God, when people used to talk about organics 30 years ago, people would chuckle, you know. And now, so I think that, look, we've seen a lot of progress in some ways. Sometimes it's in the domains you don't really expect it. But there's room for optimism, too, in the sense that if you look, you work on things, and we have seen an enormous amount of progress. There are a lot of, let's take sexual attitudes. I mean, I would have been stunned to if you told me 15 years ago, even, or 10 years ago, how rapidly things like, you know, gay movements and transgender movements, how rapidly these things would gain traction and really alter the worldview of even the majority of people. So, you know, there are moments where things will surprise you. And it's true that in history there are moments, you know, when the Berlin Wall fell, when, you know, but you can't cling to that idea that there'll be a magical solution. It doesn't mean that things don't sometimes change in a really positive way. The things also get co-opted. So, yes, we work on organics, but then all the big food corporations start to buy off the little companies. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
still it's better as long as it's improvement, but it's a dynamic. It's a dialectic,
mm-hmm.
pardon the old Marxist term, Hegelian Marxist term. But
mm-hmm.
so that's what we have to understand. There's a constant flow, a give and take. There's progress, and then it gets partially co-opted. But that's the nature of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the nature of the way things flow. And we just have to have a wider view. But there are a lot of things that have changed for the better in many, many ways. I'm not by any means, you know, a cynic. I'm
mm-hmm.
at times pessimistic, but I'm not cynical. I think one has an obligation to do one's best and to bear witness and to, you know, try to improve things in whatever way one can. There are some people who are not drawn to politics, who are, you know, just passionate about their poetry or their alternative, you know, or their health practice, and that's all right, as long as they're not harming other people in a really active way and having horrible environmental habits and driving SUVs, you know, into walls with great frequency, you know, then so be it. You know what I mean? Some people have a calling. You have to follow, you know, you have to follow your calling
mm-hmm.
in life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and try to be happy, because if you're a dour, depressing activist, striving, people won't be attracted to you anyway. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to come out of some kind of joy at doing it, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the brokenheartedness that I was mentioning before. It's
mm-hmm.
tough, man. I can't say I, you know, live up to those ideals. There are utopian ideals on the personal level, but, you know, but I live with that ideal, and you do your best. But so, yeah, I think, but there are, I think the example of that idea of nature deficit disorder, which Richard Louv, you know, and other people came up with, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting children back into nature. There's a lot of great battles out there, and if you find a good niche that you really believe in, that's as revolutionary
mm-hmm.
as anything. Taking kids out to the woods and
great.
Food co-ops, you know?
Yep. No, I mean, I'll tell you, I have a natural setting I go to, and when I go there, I tend to forget there are any problems in the world at all, you know. But then I think, well, I'm so privileged to be here, you know. So anyway, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much, JP Alcbigny, Bioneers Conference Associate Producer, author of I'm looking at the wrong thing here. Political Ecosystems, Double Helix Hubris, Delusions of Normality. I have to read that one. And Animal Encounters. Look for his work under Bioneers at Medium.com, where he's written several articles and will hopefully continue to contribute. Thank you so much for being with us on today's show, JP.
That was great fun, Allison. So.
Yeah, it was lovely.
See you around the neighborhood.
Definitely. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Chin up, be well, keep marching forward.
Well, well, well.